Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to A Word with Tom Merritt. I'm Tom Merritt. Welcome back to the parade of not telling you what to think. There's a lot of people out there telling you what to think. Some of them are worth listening to, but that's not what we do here. Here, we talk about how we all think about stuff, how we sift through all that information out there. We have a conversation and hopefully expose has some examples that are useful for you. These are the kinds of conversations I've been having all my life with my grandpa Carl in his front room, with my grandma Roxy in her front room, talking about the news of the day and the stories of their lives. I got lots of different ways of looking at the world. Great conversations. And it was all leading up to this moment right now. Welcome to the front room, Josh Grisdale.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for doing this. It's funny how we've gotten to know each other. You are a listener to some of the other shows that I do, and you are also a website operator. Tell us a little bit about the website you operate first.
So actually I have a couple different websites. I actually have a full-time job as well. I do the websites in my spare time, and my full-time job is actually doing website stuff. So I spend a lot of time on the web. But the ones that are not for my job are Accessible Japan. It's a website about traveling to Japan with a disability. And you may have guessed the reason I did that is because I have a disability. And the other one I run is called Tabufolk. A similar vein to Accessible Japan in that it's about accessible travel. But it's sort of more of a cross between maybe Twitter and Reddit for finding accessible travel information in a community setting.
And one of the reasons you do Accessible Japan is that you not only live in Japan, but you are a citizen, right?
That is correct. Yeah. I want to have a website that I wish I had before I first came here.
Before you first came. So people out there might be guessing that I wanted to talk to you about accessibility, which we absolutely could do. And I'm sure it'll come up a lot. But I wanted to talk to you specifically about the word immigrate. Because you have done something that I don't think a lot of people would have the tenacity to do, which is to uproot yourself from, I believe, Canada, right? Originally?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Near Toronto.
And moved to Japan, and not only moved to Japan, I think a lot of people talk about or even do move to Japan and work for a while. I have a good friend, Patrick Beja, who did that previously, but you decided to make it your home.
I did permanently, and I became a Japanese citizen, which means because Japan doesn't have dual citizenship, I had to give up my Canadian citizenship. So there's no going back in the regular sense of the term. So I'm here for good, unless I choose to immigrate somewhere else, maybe.
Yeah, right. That's a big step. That's a big commitment. So I want to go right to the big question of why you decided to make such a big change.
It was sort of a difficult decision, but at the same time, it was sort of that's sort of where everything was heading. So I had come to Japan the first time back in 2000, I'd say. So after I finished high school, and I came a couple times for vacation, and I was always impressed. I had this vision of it not being an accessible place for people in wheelchairs like myself. But it was better than I expected. And every time I came back, it was better than it was before, and there's more things I could do than I could before. And so I found that really encouraging, and I got the courage that I thought, this is the place I want to live. And I came here in 2007 permanently, at that time I didn't know if it was permanently, but I came to live in Japan in 2007. And then I moved a couple of different jobs, and I'm not sure about the States or Canada actually, because I didn't immigrate to Canada. But there's a number of different visa statuses that you can have in Japan. You can be a visitor, or you can be on a work visa or a spousal visa. And there's permanent residency. And then on top of that, there's naturalization. And I felt that, it was really, it's a place I really want to stay. I felt more and more at home here, and it was something that I wanted to put down roots and live here. But, if you're doing that, again, I'm not sure about in States, but in Japan, the work visas are tied to your workplace, so your employer. Mm. So if all of a sudden I was fired from my job or my company closed down, I would lose my status as being able to live in Japan, and I would have to go back to Canada no matter what. Even if I want to change jobs, I would need to find an employer that would be willing to be another sponsor, or would be willing to be a sponsor. Mm-hmm. And then I would have to coordinate it well that I would have a transfer visa to my new indentured servanthood. And so I wanted some sort of stability. So there's the choice between permanent residency and naturalization. And, I felt that my future was in Japan. And, if you go for citizenship, you have not only just the benefit of living in Japan, but you also have the rights of every other citizen, which means being able to participate in politics and the rights to reside in Japan, which, of course, has been a big thing because of Corona. I think a lot of people who felt that, I have permanent residency, I can just come and go whenever I want, they're all of a sudden locked out of Japan when the borders closed. Whereas Japanese citizens were allowed to come back whenever they want. So it's wanting to put down roots in a permanent way, but also to be involved in a deeper level with the community.
Was it particularly difficult or just long or both to you become the citizen? What was the barrier like there?
Yeah, I'd always been under the impression, and I'd been told by people as well, and misinformation that it's impossible to become a Japanese citizen. Even if you're here 100 years, it'll be easier to be, something like, taken up to heaven in a chariot alive than to become a Japanese citizen. So wow. I was like, that's really impossible. So I've just always been under that impression. But at my current workplace, one of my co-workers, she's from China originally. She had just become a Japanese citizen when I entered that workplace. And so she's sort of my senpai, I guess you'd say. It's sort of Japanese, person with more knowledge than you or above you. And so she sort of said, you can apply for it. And so I started looking around and I found a website called turning-japanese.info. And it was by an American guy who had become a Japanese citizen. I didn't realize it had been a possibility. The process, again, I thought, it's going to be impossible. And in particular, because of my disability, I was quite worried. I've heard horror stories of people even trying to go from, say, Britain to Canada with a family member who has a disability, that they would, be told by immigration that, having somebody with medical needs like that would be a burden on the healthcare system. So, we can't let you immigrate. And so I had all these, I heard some horror stories and rumors, and I felt that, even if I apply, I'm probably going to be rejected. But I was encouraged by the guy that ran the site as well as my co-worker that, just to give it a try. The worst thing is going to say no. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the requirements for becoming a Japanese citizen, it doesn't mention anything about health or anything like that. There are actually only 5 really requirements. You have to be over 18. You have to have lived in Japan for about 5 years continuously in the recent 5 years. You have to have means to support yourself. You have to have no criminal record, and you have to promise that you're not going to overthrow the government. And those are the 5 requirements. So,
seems reasonable.
I can't, the last one I haven't done yet, but got my foot in the door. So I'm here. So.
Right. So yeah. Those don't seem particularly onerous requirements. It sounds like, the living there 5 years certainly makes sure that you get used to the place and are really mean that you want to be there. I get that. And I don't think that's too unusual in immigration situations to require a certain amount of residency before actual naturalization. But did you find that, once you had met all those criteria, it was pretty simple or smooth, or were there bumps along the way?
It was a lot like anything else in Japan when you're dealing with the government. It's just a lot of paperwork and processing. So there was never any time I felt that it was in question as to whether I'd get it. You first go to, it's actually not immigration, it's the Ministry of Justice you go to. So I went for an interview, and then you get told what kind of documents you need, because it sort of depends on what country you're immigrating from, or immigrating from. So the things you are required to bring in and provide are different, and there's sort of a little bit of a sub-screening. You get all those together and you submit your package. My friend who runs the site basically sort of said that you're pretty much like 95% guaranteed to get it at that point, because they don't want to submit something that's just going to be rejected. So if they accept your package, then you're pretty likely to get it. So again, it depends on where you're coming from. But for example, if people from China or Korea, they have a family registrar. It's been a while since I spoke in English. So it's sort of like your family, you know, who your family, your parents are, who your siblings are, grandparents are. And it's sort of like a family record. And they have that in China and Korea. So basically they just need a translation of that. But for someone from maybe Canada, where that's not as an important cultural aspect, you have to provide documentation on all of, like, you know, so I have to provide my birth certificate, my parents' wedding certificate, my sister's birth certificates. I think my parents' birth certificates as well. But just again, so that they can create that document. So that took some time. We have to get professionally translated as well. I can't just, yeah, it says this. There's a lot of documents, tax documents, stuff like that. That took me about, because I had to go to Canada, get my parents to get documents from Canada and get them translated. So that took about maybe 3 to 4 months, and then I submitted it, and that was about maybe 7 months. I think it was about a year in total that I was there, but you're not allowed to leave the country without telling them. They actually do come and look at your house to make sure that you are living where you're living. So the guy came in, he looked around for 5 minutes, and said, okay, and he talks to your neighbors apparently. So it's sort of all up to their discretion, but just a bureaucracy more than anything, it seems.
It sounds like a lot of it is the kinds of things you would expect that are meant to make sure you are who you say you are and all of that. The registry thing is interesting. Is that because they're building a replica of what you would have had if you had always lived in Japan?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody in Japan has a family registry.
Yeah.
And so because I hadn't had one existing, and so I need to be put in the system. So that was a need to compile that, basically. So it meant also that I couldn't do it subtly. Wasn't sure how to bring it up with my family. So, but at the point where I needed my mother's birth certificate and, wedding certificate and stuff like that, I can't really just do that by myself. So that's sort of the opening to the questions about that. So.
Right. And did you have to get, like, you had to get certified copies of those, I expect? But those would be in English or French. They wouldn't be in Japanese.
So they were certified copies. And then I had to get them professionally translated by a translation company. And also the company had to, like, sign some sort of, or at least make a legal statement that these are, you know, properly translated. You stand by those. And then that's what you submit to the office.
So like you said, because of the family registry aspect of it, you can't just, you know, surprise mom and dad, I'm a Japanese citizen. When you talk to them about the fact that you wanted to immigrate, how did they react?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I got different reactions from different family members. So my parents weren't against it, but they were sad, I think is the phrasing they used, but they wanted, what I wanted for my future is what was most important to them. They said, I think that not getting the Japanese citizenship as much as that I have to give up my Canadian citizenship.
Yeah. Right.
I think probably every, you know, parent has the, you know, if somebody, their son or daughter goes overseas, that they'll come back eventually kind of, feeling. Yeah. And I think so this was sort of a permit, like, oh, he's not coming back kind of thing. So I think that was the challenge. My sister's, were a bit angrier. They've come to accept it. They actually came back in 2019 before the pandemic started. So I think that was nice for them just to see where it is I'm living to sort of get a bit of a sense of the idea.
Yeah, I can imagine that that would give you all kinds of mixed feelings while you're going through all this trouble too. Mm-hmm. Did you ever second guess and wonder if it was really worth all the effort and the anger from your sisters?
So if they hear this, they're not that angry. they were what are you doing?
The mild irritation from your sisters.
No, I mean, definitely it's sort of like a kind of situation like where you really, really think about a lot of things, I think, about, you know, who you are, et cetera, and your future much more than just, you know, renewing a visa. And so I think that, I think there's along the road, I was like, you know, am I really going to go with this? I wasn't sure. I was pretty sure I was going to get it, but at the same time, it's kind of like, you know, well, I might not. But at the same time, I guess I kept coming back to, if I don't get it and I have to go back at some point, or if I sign up to get it and I go back, you know, will I be happy kind of thing? And I think that I've put down such roots in Japan, and I feel that, you know, this is a place I feel really comfortable and love that, I think that I would be able to be happy in the same way in Canada. So I felt that that was, you know, probably that's what was probably the best move to do.
If you'd be just become a permanent resident, what would have been the difference?
The difference is that, yeah, you can't, so you, permanent residency, you get most of the cake. So you can work where you want. You can live where you want, and you're not allowed to vote, of course. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, yeah, you still have to renew it, I think, every 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's also a process as well. I think I heard from somebody that they're actually stricter for the permanent residency applications, because it's sort of a nice situation that you don't have any responsibility, but you get the benefit of living in Japan. That whereas, you know, if you're going to apply for naturalization, then you're throwing all your chips in, and this person must really, really want it. And So I think the guy that ran the site always made the point that, you know, having the permanent residency, you get permission to live in Japan. But you don't have the right to live in Japan. And at the time, I was like, oh, you know, well, it's not like Canada and Japan are going to go to war anytime soon or anything like that. But then, you know, with the pandemic coming up, that really, was highlighted. You know, there's a lot of people that, like, you know, they were here in Japan on permanent residencies, and they had, you know, family members pass away in their homelands, and they want to go back for a funeral. But if they go back, they wouldn't be allowed back into Japan. And they had no idea when it would be that they would be allowed back into Japan. So, you know, that'd mean giving up their job and their and stuff like that. So, yeah, for myself, that, you know, I want to be, again, involved. You know, I have some opportunities to be involved in Japanese government here. I have no inclination to run for politics or anything like that, but I do feel it's a very important.
Never say never, but
we'll see. And you can have me back for a flip flopper one day when you use that word on the show.
be the word there.
Yeah.
But it sounds like that public participation aspect is important to you. And I can see that being important to plenty of people.
Yeah. It wasn't when I was back in Canada. I wasn't really, I sort of always voted because my parents had a better vote. As I went, you know, got older, and I felt that, you know, it's important to, you know, that, well, particularly maybe as someone with a disability, that, you know, the policies and, you know, the way that, you know, the government goes has quite a profound effect on me, probably more than other people. So I wanted to make sure that, I had my views heard by the government. So.
Yeah. Do you do advocacy for accessibility and disability that you might not be able to do if you weren't a citizen?
No, I actually did. I did ask that. I'm on a couple of boards. I'm on one for the Ministry of Transportation, on their disability appraisal committee kind of thing. So they tell about the latest, improvements they've made to accessibility around Japan, and we have our opportunity to give comments, stuff like that. So I did ask, you know, if I hadn't been a Japanese citizen, would I be able to do this? And they're like, yeah, no, that's fine. Because part of I'm coming from sort of the accessible Japan point of view. So it's sort of, I'm sort of the international point of view that, that they wanted. So, so I don't think it would affect it necessarily, but it definitely, you know, does, I think, probably help people to accept my point of view more that, you know, I've decided to become Japanese citizen as opposed to just some sort of, you know, foreigner saying you should be like us, you know, or something like that.
Yeah. It gives you a little more legitimacy, I guess, even if just for your own point of view, I could see that. Mm-hmm. During the process of naturalization, when you're collecting all of these papers and getting the package before the package is accepted, did you ever run into any opposition? Anybody who felt like maybe they were dragging their heels on purpose or didn't want you to get it?
Not particularly. Like from the government side?
From the side. Well, actually, I hadn't even thought about any other side, but I suppose if you were running into people who were discouraging you from doing it for any reason, that'd be interesting too.
My mother could have dragged her feet, but she didn't, thankfully. She's the document controller, master of documents.
Sure. I guess you're right, yeah.
Yeah, so if she had I'm sure I could have, like, you know, I think actually they do ask, you know, how does your family feel about you immigrating? Mm-hmm. That is part of it. So I didn't really necessarily feel that. There's a lot of, like, on that website, there's a lot of different stories of different people's experiences. And some people didn't have the house inspection. Other people did. It sort of depends on, I think, where you're living, I think who you are as well. So some people would maybe have, maybe, like, you know, that might have been why they decided to look at me, because, you know, maybe they had a few more questions. So they decide, okay, well, we have the opportunity to do a check, so we'll do a check. Whereas other people, like, I've heard that they sort of look on Google Maps to make sure it's not, you know, some sort of office building or something like that.
Right.
But because they're just busy. But so I think that might have been some of it. It did take a bit longer than I expected, because I had heard some people got it within like 4 months. Whereas other people had like a year and a half. So it took me about a year. So I was a little bit worried. It's interesting. The way you find out is there's this thing called Kampo, which is sort of the government gazette. So I guess like the National Archives kind of thing. And it's published daily, different activities, sort of like a little newsletter from the government. I posted it on a PDF on one of the government websites every morning at 9 a.m. So I would go on, and one of the columns is the people who have naturalized. So every day I'd look for my name, and then close it in disgust until the next day. So that's eventually how I found out. And then afterwards I got a call about it. So
did you save that PDF?
Yeah. And I had it. It's not there now, but I did have it taped to the wall above my desk at work. So the highlight on my name. Nice. Yeah.
I would assume that living with a wheelchair, you are someone who is used to having to have a little more complexity in your life and having to have a little more patience. Do you think that helped you with that process of immigration?
No, I'm not that patient.
Yeah.
I'm actually, it's probably also makes me a bit of a worry wart. So I was paranoid about everything. I made me appreciate Japan more, I think. You know, I mentioned before about the people not getting because of the accessibility or disability. And so that, you know, I was really worried about that when I made my application. I tried to make every effort to assure them that, no, I'm going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Just because I have a disability doesn't mean I can't support myself and, et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't seem to care. and then eventually, you know, when I got it, it's like, you know, it didn't seem to be an issue at all. They didn't seem to have any questions about it. I think partly is because it's quite compartmentalized. So like the people making that decision are unrelated to the people making healthcare or welfare policy decisions. So it doesn't really matter to them. You know, I'm
sure,
you know, and also at that point, Japan had signed the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. So you're not allowed to make any sort of discrimination based on disabilities. I don't know how much effect that had, but I was always holding that card, you know, just in case.
Yeah, can't hurt, right?
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about the process here because I think that's interesting for people who haven't gone through it to see what it's like. But I want to go back to the root of this. Why Japan at all? Like, what drew you to be interested in even going to Japan in the first place?
Yeah, so I was from Canada. I was I was born in Toronto is what I always say. And whenever people ask, I'm from Toronto. I lived there for 4 years, but then we moved to the middle of nowhere, but outside of Toronto, but an hour away from there. I lived on a farm and my dad worked at IBM. So it was sort of a hobby farm, but
okay.
Yeah. So, but it was still in the middle of nowhere. And at my high school, we actually had a Japanese class and, it was run by somebody who wasn't
Japanese. Farm town had a Japanese class? I'm jealous now.
So it was sort of the Board of Education in that area required that all high school teachers have two teachable subjects. And the guy who ran the auto mechanics class, he didn't have a second teachable, but had lived in Japan for a while. So he asked if he could make a Japanese course and use that as a second teachable. So that's how he started the class. And he taught the class very much in an auto mechanics kind of way in terms of there's no real deadlines for homework. Tests are sort of optional. Well, not really optional, but you do a test and then you pass it to the person next to you to mark and that's fine. And every Friday was Culture Friday. And so we ate fresh baked cookies from the cafeteria while we watched bootlegged dramas from Japan. So that's how I got interested in Japan. The reason I took the course, I should say, is that at that point, it's probably about 1995, 96, I guess. And so the Japanese economic bubble had ended, but Japan was still quite a big player, you know, and I felt that, you know, I want to get into IT because I like computers. And I thought, you know, it's a really competitive field. So if I have something, then get, you know, me noticed on my resume that I can speak Japanese as well. That would be good. So that's why I started taking Japanese, but we had to take French as well in school, of course. And I hated it. And I think that, you know, it's all the drills and all the, like, it sort of made me turn against it. I think probably if the Japanese class had been the same way, I might've only taken it once, but because of the way the teacher taught it. And we also found out that, you know, if you could get him talking, he just sort of go on to the end of class. So we'd always come up with all these questions about, like, so, you know, in Japan, what's it like working in an office and stuff like that? And he'd go on for maybe an hour and then all class is over. But because of that, it's sort of, you know, again, sort of more, you know, opportunities to, you know, learn a bit about Japanese culture. And sometimes he had Japanese, like, you know, people had come for a homestay. They'd stay at his house and they'd come into the class. So we'd have opportunities to meet real Japanese people. And so that's where I got interested. And then at the end of high school, you know, before going to university, like my family, they always make sure that we get a good international experience. So one of my sisters went to Bolivia. My other little sister, she went to somewhere. I can't remember where it is she went, but you know, my parents want me to do that as well. So I wanted to go to Japan, of course. So that's how I got interested in Japan in the first place. And I came back after that and went to university, studied mathematics, but I took also a minor in East Asian studies. So I just took some more Japanese there, went back for vacations. And every time is, again, like you mentioned before, it was a bit better than before. So I really, really felt that it was a place that I could continue to come to and enjoy. And I felt more and more that I really want to live there. So that's why Japan. So I don't know if maybe they had a Korean class. I you know, I would have been in Korea right now.
If that mechanic had worked for Samsung instead of
exactly.
or something. Yeah. I'm curious because it could have gone another way. You could have taken the Japanese class, been sort of interested, traveled to Japan and been like, it's okay, you know, and gone a different route. Do you have an idea of what it was that kind of confirmed, like, oh yeah, no, this really appeals to me? Cause I would imagine it would have to be something pretty strong to lead you to eventually become a citizen like you have.
Yeah. I think that probably because I'd been learning some Japanese as well, I think that helped. I think if I had just gone there without any Japanese at all, it would have, again, felt more like a vacation kind of thing. But, you know, sort of the excitement of being able to use Japanese you learned in class and have somebody understand you and then just sort of get better at it each time. And I think, you know, for me, like I quite enjoy, you know, the cultural, like the history and the culture, and it's sort of, it's always learning. I'm always learning something new, even now. I think it's really hard to put into words exactly what it was. There wasn't necessarily one aha moment or anything like that, but it was just sort of like every time I came, I think every time I came, I get excited. And every time I got on the train to go to Narita Airport, I got really, really sad. And it was sort of, you know, the train leaves because Narita Airport is out in Chiba, which is, you know, it's about an hour and a bit out of Tokyo. And so you get on the train, and so then you're in the middle of the city, and gradually the houses get more suburban. And then it's all of a sudden, you know, you see these like rice fields and forestry areas, and then all of a sudden it's an airport. And it sort of, I always felt, you know, as the houses went away and we got into the rice fields, it got sort of more and more heavy in the heart kind of thing. And so I felt that that's probably, you know, something like that. So
I want to talk a little bit about, we've talked a lot about your immigration experience, but I wanted to talk a little bit about immigration in general and your perspective on it, because when people in the United States hear the word immigration, they immediately think politics and the southern border and illegal immigration and things like that. What does the word mean to you when you think of it, since you are an immigrant? And someone who chose to do it, you weren't fleeing oppression or anything like that. What do you think of when you hear immigrate?
Yeah, I think my family has a number of people who immigrated to Canada. So both my grandparents on my mother's side were immigrants. My dad's side were a lot longer in Canada, but obviously, you know, immigrated at some point. My older sister, her husband is an immigrant to Canada from Ghana, and the only person in our family that is not an immigrant is my younger sister's husband, who is Algonquin. First Nations. So he's the only one that can say, "Hey, get out here, you immigrants."
His family immigrated much longer ago than the rest of us. So yeah,
so getting him across the Bering Strait, but right. Yeah. So so it's not something that's foreign to my family, I think. And to me, I think, like you mentioned, the politics thing, I think particularly in America, a little bit elsewhere in Canada, there seems to be sort of like a really split in terms of the way of thinking of immigrant or immigration. You know, there's some people, it's sort of like, you know, the mention before, you know, the illegal or you know, taking jobs or changing what we've always been like kind of thing. But on the other side, there's other people who are like, you know, who had a dream to come, and, you know, they saved up and they worked hard, and they, you know, they came over and then they picked themselves up from the bootstraps, and they made something from that's the American dream, you know, and the Statue of Liberty and all that kind of stuff. And so I think it's a really loaded word for sure. For myself as well, I think I probably had a lot of, you know, that was my main impression. So sometimes I have to remind myself, yeah, I'm an immigrant. And so, cause it doesn't really fit with the image I've seen, you know, my whole life. I mean, I guess it's like, you know, I was looking it up as well, because, you know, this is the word, and how, you know, just sort of like, it's somewhat of a relatively new word, apparently, but, you know, it's something that's been happening since all of, you know, time and people moving around. But I think it's about, you know, putting down roots, I think, is in a place that's not where you are from. And that could be even, I think, you know, obviously the word now means like crossing borders, but I think a lot of, you know, even just, you know, like yourself, you've moved across the States and you've immigrated to Los Angeles. In a way, right? You know, you've set down roots in a place.
It was really easy though.
Probably a lot less paperwork. But so I mean, I think that in some ways, yeah, it feels, it's weird to say because I'm talking about myself, but, you know, explorer or courage or like, you know, having a dream or something like that. It's sort of my feeling of it, you know, looking for a future in a different place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Or not necessarily starting over, although it could also be that, but new starts, new horizons, that sort of thing.
So that's sort of my impression in a good way. Yeah. So, I mean, like my grandparents, they both came over. Like my mom's dad, he fled Bulgaria. Because they were, you know, it was during the Balkan, some Balkan wars. I'm sure there's frequently Balkan wars.
There have been many.
Yeah. So that's why he came over. But you know, my grandma, she came over for better economic opportunities for their family. So yeah, I mean, it's like that was sort of like, you know, different sides of that. And my brother-in-law as well, as they came over, brought their skills over and went to work in Canada for their children. So I mean, I think that's a very looking forward to the future and what's best for yourself and your family. And that's sort of my vision, I think. Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I feel like a lot of the attitudes around immigration are rooted in our history as a species in creating our communities. And people who are listening to these episodes probably noticed I tend to try to understand things by evolutionary advantage. Like, why did humans develop this? What was the thing that made us develop this? And having an identifiable community is important, so that you know who you can trust without having to, you know, go through the negotiation of figuring it out every time, right? Oh, they're in my community, so, you know, I can take a shortcut and trust them. And immigration, I think a lot of the attitudes are, how do we make sure that this person that we're bringing into our community from the outside fits and is trustworthy and will contribute and won't be a burden, like you were saying, on the community. Does that jive with how you think about it too?
Yeah, I think, I mean, well, looking way, way back in history, we migrate for better opportunities, for more food, or, you know, following a certain animal or something like that. But then, yeah, I think there's probably a lot more immigration and migration that we recognize in the ancient world. And, throughout history, it's more probably recently with, you know, more solidified, you know, borders and nation states that it's become more of a topic. I'm sure there's lots of people that, you know, would just, you know, they'd be maybe an outsider for a while, but they'd eventually be welcomed into communities. But, I would say that sounds fairly similar to my thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah. There's more people now, right? It was one thing when you could just wander, you know, miles and miles and miles hunting and gathering and not run into anybody else. Yeah. You could, you know, you could immigrate quite easily. Do you feel Japanese culturally yet?
Okay, that's an excellent question. So that's also been a journey for myself. Mm-hmm. So I go back to my family again. My Bulgarian grandfather, he wanted to be Canadian. And so he got mad at my mom when she tried to learn some Bulgarian words. And he said, no, we're Canadian. Mm-hmm. And then she called her uncle by his Bulgarian name. And he's like, nope, that's Uncle Ben. You call him Uncle Ben. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I think, maybe, I don't know if it's a generational thing or if it's
It's a common story I've heard in different immigrant situations where the family is like, no, we're starting over and we want to assimilate, you know, so we speaking the whatever the language is, wherever they go. I've heard that before. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, but Japan is quite a bit different than I think, you know, Canada or the US or other parts of Europe as well. Whereas immigration, well, it's not like not as uncommon as I previously believed. It's still not that common. A lot of people who do immigrate here are from other parts of Asia. So they're not as many people from Europe or North America coming here. So it's a bit, that's why it's probably having a vision of being rare. But I think to become Japanese, I think at first, a lot of people living in Japan long term, at first feel really like a honeymoon phase where they're like, I'm feeling a Japanese. I got Japanese friends. I eat Japanese food, and I can speak some Japanese. And then I think they hit a wall at some point where it's like there's something they can't cross over and be like the other Japanese, or like other people who are Japanese and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's always, even sometimes I get it quite frequently. You know, like it's just like, you know, I've lived here for 15 years now. I've been Japanese citizen for 6 years. I've had friends I've known here the whole 15 years, and they still commonly ask, you know, what about in Canada? And it's like, that's the only thing about me that they can see is that I'm not Japanese. Mm-hmm. So at first that's still something like I laugh about it now, but you know, it does sometimes, you know, bother me that there's still something that's like, you know, I will never be able to overcome. But at the same time, I think I read something somewhere and it's sort of like dawned on me that Well, one of the unique things about Japan is that it's both a country and an ethnicity, which I think is something a little bit different than, you know, the States or Canada, where it's a country first and there's no real one ethnicity that you could say right. that this is you have American genes or something like that. You can't say that. So whereas like I'm a Japanese citizen, but I will never be ethnically Japanese.
Sure.
And so I can learn a lot about culture and do my best, but there's still something that, you know, I will never have because I moved here when I was 26. I don't know in the education system that, you know, this word means this particular thing in a classroom drill or something like that, because I never experienced it. So there's the lack of experience on one part. There's lack of, like, you know, a lot of cultural knowledge I don't have that at first it did bug me, but at the same time, it's like, you know, well, I need to accept who I am as part of my story, that I am somebody who was born in a different country. I had different upbringing. I spoke a different language. I decided to immigrate into Japan and make this my new home. I learned a new language and picking up new things. So I'm, you know, a Japanese citizen, but I usually introduce myself as, you know, I'll say that, you know, I'm a Japanese citizen, or I have Japanese citizenship, or born in a foreign country and I'm a Japanese citizen. So I think that really helped me come to terms with, you know, my identity. And otherwise I think I probably would have been struggling with, you know, no matter how much I learned, no, how much I put effort I put into things, I will never be Japanese enough. So I think that sort of really helped along my journey.
I mean, it says to me, based on what I know from my wife's father, my father-in-law is a first generation immigrant from the Philippines. You're a first generation immigrant to Japan, yeah. right? And a first generation means they speak with an accent. They probably grew up speaking a different language and had different experiences growing up because they grew up in a different country. And that all applies to you. You didn't grow up in the Japanese educational system, you know, et cetera. But, you know, were you to have children, they would. And then they would be more part of the culture, more part of that, because they would be second generation.
Yeah, and they'd be asking me for help for homework, and I wouldn't be able to write the character that they want me to.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah,
it's definitely a real problem.
Yeah, you're first generation. That's nothing unusual. That happens a lot. It sounds like it doesn't happen as much in Japan, maybe.
Not as much, and maybe not as much from Western countries, or different countries, you know, so Western countries.
That's
so.
True. What was the TV show that Apple did about the Korean immigrants in Japan?
Pachinko.
Yeah. If anybody wants to see that part of immigration, it's a great story. But it did show that you could pass as Japanese sometimes if you're an immigrant from other Asian cultures. Not all the time. There are definitely differences, but you could in some situations. People might not notice. Whereas I know this is an audio podcast, but you could probably guess that Josh is not going to be mistaken at first glance as being from Japan.
And my camera is also making me extra white right now. So
yeah, but if you could see his camera there, would I emphasize it. Right. But yeah, are there immigrant communities that you know of or participate in?
Yeah, not that I participate in necessarily, though that is actually something that's a bit interesting as well. I live in the east side of Tokyo, and the ward that I live in has the highest level of immigrants in Tokyo. And in particular, I think it's about 40% Chinese, but we also have a very, very large Indian population. So in some areas you go to, actually one of our, like, city council persons was also a Japanese nationalized citizen, but was from India originally. And so that was sort of, we do have a few people in politics that are, you know, not naturally, born Japanese people, but, I don't think we have the same rule that, they have in the States about the president must be American born. So in theory, I could probably become the leader of Japan. In theory,
no kidding.
But I don't know if that would ever happen. But
I'd say you have my vote, but I can't vote. So, yeah.
but there are communities. There's some Korean communities in Western Tokyo where it's people, especially like right now, it's quite a boom for, you know, BTS and stuff like that. So people will go there to buy Korean candies and stuff like that, or makeup and stuff like that. So there are some. I think that it also depends on your back. Like, for a long time, I think it's kind of funny because, like, my friend and I came to Japan a long time ago. He is a backpacker, and he said that, you know, whenever he was backpacking across South America or Central America, you'd come across another backpacker, and then all of a sudden you'd be friends. Like, you'd go backpack together and stuff like that. Let's go, just go for a little bit together. Whereas, he said that, like, why is it that all the, you know, foreign people in Japan are so cold? And, you know, you see each other on the train, but you don't acknowledge each other. And, and so, you know, I think that's something some people try really hard to, to not be part of foreign communities as well. So that's part of, you know, everybody's journey. And I think at first I was like that, but lately I've made, you know, some friends who are long-term residents in Japan that are, from Australia and, actually somebody from Bulgaria as well. So that was kind of a, and I think it's important to, just be to open to all those things. And I guess everybody's on a different journey and it takes time to get where you're going. So.
I wonder sometimes if we're at, an early part of a stage in human history where we still see the old boundaries that were caused by the difficulty of travel, but they are starting to erode. And as you mentioned, you know, the fact there isn't a Canadian ethnicity, there's not a U.S. ethnicity, is new. It's unusual. You don't see that as often. And it's problematic in many ways because it's a result of colonization and conquering, versus, you know, natural, like slow, the more slow motion, immigration that we saw in the past. Conquering that happened so long ago, like the Norman conquest that everybody forgets about it. Right. But you are starting to see, I see it most in the UK, probably because I pay more attention to the UK. I'm sure it's happening elsewhere where you see that it is becoming multicultural. It is not, you know, people whose families have lived in England or Scotland, you know, for centuries all the time. I feel like Japan isn't as far down that road, right? If the US and Canada are at one end and the UK is maybe in the middle, do you think Japan is farther back, close, moving that way in stasis? I don't know.
It's definitely further back. It is changing. I think that, the loaded word of immigrant, I think that, there's usually two big issues that people bring up when they're against immigration. Somebody will say something like, stealing our jobs or something like that is one common issue. The other is changing the fabric of our society or something like that, right? And I think that's much more the concern here in Japan. I think that there's we have a huge aging population, so we don't have enough people to do the jobs. And it's sort of been traditional that,
as people get old, they're just dropping out of the workforce.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And before there was the 3 Ks, I don't know if I remember it now, Kitsui, Kusai, I can't remember what it is, the other ones, but stinky, hard to do, and something other jobs that's what the ones that the foreigners would have to do kind of thing. So it was really not they're taking our jobs, as much as, just concern over what will happen to Japan, is our culture going to be forgotten? Is it going to change? I have one person in my workplace who's a bit older who is a little bit vocal on those kind of areas, who it was upset because on the bus routes lately, they've been using English as well. Or things like, why do we need to put English on the bus routes or something like that? The way foreign guidebooks, et cetera, say maybe, Senzoji, temple, where G means temple. So sort of like Senzo, temple.
It's the ATM machine of temples.
Yeah, exactly. that's the more common conversation in Japan. So I think that it's something that's definitely growing pains here in Japan. Now, I think it's just inevitable that, as I mentioned before, it's just so much easier to move around. And even if people don't become Japanese citizens, there are a lot of people who come here, they get married and they have children who are of, both, backgrounds. They're called, I don't like the word, but half here in Japan. So it, again, mm-hmm. sort of not, yeah. sort of the way I'm thinking is like you're half Japanese, you know, you're not fully Japanese. Whereas, and some of these people have spent their life in Japan. They only speak, like, sometimes a joke. There's some comedians that are, you know, their mixed ethnicities and they tend to look, and some of the people who don't look Japanese at all, they will get, you know, well, can you help me with English and stuff like that? It's like, I don't speak English at all. You know, like that. So, I never learned English at all. And, so, I mean, it's definitely something I think that Japan is dealing with right now, but, we're on a big, SDGs, pitch right now. So everybody's is being more conscious about that, and diversity and inclusion is something that's come to Japan now and people are talking about it.
Oh, okay. Still, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. We have you know, a lot more of conversations about that now. So, I mean, it's definitely, even in the 15 years I've lived here, it's changed quite a bit in terms of that. Mm.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it till we were talking, but I wonder if just the acceleration of change, both by increased transportation and a movement of information, faster than ever before, if that has increased resistance to immigration, where there is resistance to it, if it's increased it because of that, because instead of a slow, like, oh, one or two people show up and we easily can bring them into our culture and learn from theirs, it starts to feel overwhelming because it's happening so fast.
Yeah, it's like that, goo that you make in elementary school where it's like, you know, if you put your finger in slowly, it doesn't, it's like the corn starch and uh-huh. water, whatever, it doesn't move. But if you try to move quickly, it turns into a block. It might be something like that, I think, too. People are a lot more open to foreigners than they even before. Like, you know, sometimes, you know, people would just be like, I don't want to speak English. I'm sorry. But now more people are much more, you know, used to foreigners being here in Japan. Because of the tourism and stuff. So
before we finish up, I like to play a little word game with folks. Are you game?
Sure. Sounds good.
It's called This or That. I will give you two things and you tell me, which you would choose and why.
Okay.
All right. We'll start with Ichiran or Ippudo.
I'm not a connoisseur of ramen. I just usually go to the place.
I was worried about that, but that's an acceptable answer, neither. I don't eat that ramen that much.
Yeah. After I got over 40, it doesn't sit as well with me. I'm not that young anymore. But if I have ramen, it's usually the place is near me. So.
Okay. Yeah. The local shop. Exactly.
It's good. The one that's in front of me.
Fast or slow zombies?
I thought a lot about this as I've been listening to the past podcasts. I have a bittersweet relationship with slow zombies. And that is because my father, he'd always go to Walmart and he'd pick up these like 80-cent videos of like these old, probably like, you know, movies that had gone into public commons and they were taped on these, you know, extra long plays. So they're horrible uh-huh. quality. And one of the ones we picked up was Night of the Living Dead. So that was the first time I watched it. So that was my first, I think that's even before the Fast Zombies came out. So that was my first, experience with zombies. I remember being so infuriated with him for buying that movie because at the end, the main guy got shot by, some other people who were killing zombies and maybe some happened. But I've always, had more of an interest in slow zombies. So the fast ones,
you have your roots in slow zombies.
I have my roots in slow zombies. Yeah.
All right. iOS or Android?
I use iOS. I have an Android phone in front of me that is not charged, which tells you how often I use it. It doesn't have a SIM card.
I think that answers the question.
Yeah.
Do you like both or are you partisan where you like really do prefer iOS?
Actually, it's funny because I used to hate, and my dad worked for IBM, so Apple was our competitive kind of thing. So, and then one of my friends got an iPod and we listened to that and that's fine, whatever. And then he got an iPod Touch. So that's sort of my first experience into like sort of that OS kind of thing. And I ended up being my first smartphone was an iPhone because of that, because I thought, oh, it's actually not that bad. And then because of that, I've been drawn into the whole Mac world. And I'd, you know, sometimes help people with their phones and they would be Android and it would frustrate me to no end because the old Android ones were so slow and clunky and every single one was different.
Especially the early ones, yeah.
Yeah, the scrolling, it would, so that was sort of always a bad impression, but I have a Google Pixel now and I've been quite impressed with how it's changed. And so I might switch, but I'm pretty much in the Mac realm now.
I like that you are still, you know, dabbling just to see where it's at with the Pixel. Well, that's good.
Well, part of the one reason is that because of for Tappy Folk, gonna be releasing an app soon, so need to, I need to check to make sure it works on Android as well. Yeah. So that was my excuse.
Another Japanese one: Shibuya Crossing or Shibuya Sky?
Sky. I'd rather look down on things than be part of the jungle.
You could look at the crossing.
Exactly.
From up there.
I'm glad I'm not there. You know. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I kind of feel the same way about Shibuya Crossing. If anybody doesn't know, it's the one you always see where there's like masses of people all all crossing at once. Yeah. I know a lot of people who like really love that crossing. I prefer to look at it than be in it myself. Although Shibuya Sky was the one place I got in trouble in Japan because I was wearing a hat.
It was going to blow off. Is that?
Yeah, there were rules about not having a hat. And when I jokingly was like, but it's cold, the lady looked at me like, that's not okay. Yeah.
No. So, yeah.
Yeah. I took it off. Like, okay, I didn't cause trouble. Yeah. It's nice up there, though. Savory or dessert crepes?
I don't have a sweet tooth, so I go for savory by default, though the only savory crepe I had, I actually didn't really like that much, but so neither.
Neither is an acceptable answer. I am surprised how many people I've talked to, and I've kept this one around, I think partially because I started to notice this, say they don't have a sweet tooth. Mm. Like I think the assumption that I would make is like, well, most people like sweet things, but I'm finding that not to be true. At least it's the people I'm talking to for the show.
The one exception I have is for ice cream. And there is a Japanese ice cream that isn't a crepe that I like because it's cold. I probably wouldn't like one of those ones, which is cream and chocolate and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I saw a savory one once that had a hot dog in it. I tried it, but the crepe was still sweet and it was horrible. So yeah, no crepes for me.
Yeah. That's a little odd. All right. The Orville or Star Trek Lower Decks?
Oh, Tom. both.
You can go both. You can go both if you don't want to pick.
I've only watched the first season of Lower Decks, and I quite enjoy it. But I've watched all of the episodes of Orville that have come out, and it's really, really grown on me. I hope it keeps coming back.
It's almost an unfair comparison because while the Orville was originally billed as comedy, it really isn't. It's just a science fiction show with some jokes sometimes.
Yeah, no, the first season was a lot more jokey. And actually, you probably saw my Twitter profile. That's why I have Bordis with a mustache on the top of that. but yeah, so the latest season was very few jokes in it, but it was just really, really got back to the, next generation kind of feel to it that I really like.
Yeah. Dogs or cats?
I am a dog person that owns a cat. I quite like dogs, but in my small apartment, I didn't really feel it'd be very fair to have a dog that, wants to go run around. And I'm at work most of the time. And then if I do come around, I can't actually do it by myself. So, the cat is a more adaptable animal in that terms.
But you're okay with both, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. My cat's grown on me quite a bit, so.
Good. Haneda or Narita Airport?
Haneda, for sure. Yeah. The trauma of Narita going out through those the rice fields, I can't forget it. But
especially after that story.
So once they did actually have, for a while, going to Toronto, you needed to use Narita. But lately, Haneda, they also have... a plane going to in Toronto now. So I unless I absolutely have to use Narita, I never do.
I've only been to Japan twice, and one time was Narita the first time. The second time was Haneda. And I agree with you. Just after those side-by-side comparison, it's much nicer. Hot or cold?
Hot. That's changed as well. When I was in Canada, I remember in high school, I'd go out in minus 10 degrees weather in a t-shirt and laugh it off. But now I'd much rather be in a hot weather than cold. So.
And that's not... It's not because Japan is particularly hot, although it gets hot in the summer, but it gets cold there in the winter as well. It's just as we age, the cold gets less appealing, I suppose.
Mm, for sure.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for opening up and talking about all of this with me. I really, really appreciate it, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And if folks want to find out more about what you do, including Accessible Japan, the other enterprises that you're involved in, where should they go?
Yeah, it's, I'm most active on Twitter. I'm at Josh Grisdale, JOSHGRISDALE. I have a emoji and a picture of Bordis on the top of my profile, so it should be easy to find. And then, Accessible Japan and Tappy Folk. You can find them on Twitter and Facebook as well, or just by searching in Google.
And Tabby Folk's all one word. Accessible Japan has a hyphen, though, right?
That's correct, yes. And Tabby Folk, Tabby is journey, and Folk is more folk. So it's people on a journey is where the name came from.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, Josh. Really appreciate it, man.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to our producers, Jen Cutter and Anthony Lemos, and thank you for listening to this show and telling your friends about it. You can get an ad-free version of this show with Acast Plus. Click on Access Exclusive Content at awordpodcast.com. We'll have a word with you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.